Hey everyone, Ron Newcomb here with the Indie Coach. I am here with Ben, and we're going to be talking about filmmaking, of course. But Ben has had a pretty epic career, if I may say so, and has had a lot, his hands on a lot, which is why I was kind of eager to get Ben on, because I think he can give a lot of big perspective, particularly from the indie the market, but is well versed in other areas, particularly around producing, distribution. He's kind of done that all, producer rep, etc. And has done a really good, from what I've seen, even before I met him, that he had a really good reputation within the industry. And that was the other thing, that is when you get into the distribution side of things, doesn't always pan out. So to have somebody who's reputable on the distribution side of the fence, I know I wanted to get Ben in. So Ben, I appreciate you joining us. And if you don't mind, if we could just dive into a little bit of how did you get into film? What was kind of your pathway and your road into filmmaking?
So yeah, I actually, that's a good question. I kind of discovered filmmaking, my senior year in high school. I had a wonderful video production teacher who is now the, executive director of the Breckenridge Film Festival.
Oh, nice.
And, his name's Steve. He is, and that kind of set me on a path. My school had to do a senior thesis, basically, and it was not just like writing something. We had to do a actual project for it. And at the time, I thought I was going to be a special ed teacher, of all things. And I ended up doing a video with my for my senior thesis on how to do a on how to take care of a particular special ed kid, because she was transitioning into a nursing home. And at that point, I kind of realized I liked the process of filmmaking better than I liked the act of being a special ed teacher. I spent a year I took a gap year between high school and college to confirm that. And I realized that I wasn't exactly destined for that thing, and went to film school.
Hmm.
Eventually ended up in following a girl to San Francisco, discovering I liked San Francisco better than the girl, and started going to the American film market, eventually re-specialized as a producer's rep from a producer. And because I realized that there weren't many people who really understood distribution or sales and had the connections into it, and it was the fastest path to a long-term career in the industry for me in particular. So I took it, and one opportunity led to another. I started a distribution company, sold that distribution company, and am now a consultant and producer's rep. And I help some sales agents with their North American sales, because I can't be a distributor until later this year because I'm under a non-compete.
Ah, gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, because producers reps have been around for a while, but I've heard different definitions of them at times. Can you maybe help guide all of us into what does a producer's rep really do or offer a producer?
So there are a lot of different definitions for it. You're right. The way I practice it is I sell directly as a sales agent would to North America.
Mm-hmm.
And then I generally work with one of only a handful of trustworthy sales agents who will actually push your film, make sales, and pay you. And I more partner with them and get the film in their hands, and then act basically as an enforcement mechanism for the filmmakers. So on the sales agency side, I'm almost a freelance acquisition consultant, would be how a lot of people would put that.
So. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, I can definitely see the need for that and why someone would, need that for sure, to kind of navigate that, particularly when on the indie side of things, if you haven't gone to one of the film markets, they can be intimidating. And then you also have all these different distributors, and then you have sales agents who call themselves distributors, but really are, focused on the foreign. If you don't know that, it's like, how do I navigate all this? And you need kind of a captain of the ship to help you go through that. When we have film, what do you think draws people into the film business? What is the allure? Is it still kind of like the old Hollywood kind of fantasy of it? Or what do you think is kind of continues to draw people in? Because I do see, at least to me, that there's a very public discussion happening where people know Hollywood is not all roses. And I think some people would be like, oh, I don't know now. I don't know that I'm going to LA at this point. But people every day, of course, still get into the industry. Why do you think that is?
I'd almost say it's more of a compulsion than a business decision. It's you do it because you can't be happy doing anything else at this point. And it's unfortunate that most people throughout the vast majority of their career will need to have some degree of side hustle or day job. There are very few who make this their full-time living. And it's just what it is. And there are a great many reasons for why that happens. And I'm sure we'll get into some of them on the podcast here. But it's a, I just, I like I said, I don't, if you're not, if you're in this industry to make money, there are easier ways. And there are significantly easier ways. Honestly, my go-to, because I did it for a little bit while I was starting my company. Or my producer's rep consultancy is selling insurance. Selling insurance, it's frankly really good money if you're good at it. And you don't even need to be all that good at it to do it. It's not like the same skill level that you need to succeed in film. It's just, and you'll probably make more money in selling insurance than you will in film. I left that life because I was not happy and I really wasn't, and I didn't see myself becoming it, no matter how successful I was. So I happened to end up in a situation where the skill set is extraordinarily similar, but the general depth of expertise is very different. And I guess the big thing is, if you're a filmmaker listening to this, understand it's not an easy road. And you'll kind of get paid better in stories than you will in money for the vast majority of your career. So take that for what it's worth.
No, I mean, we talked on previous episodes about the side hustle doesn't always equate to failure. Like many of us need to have that side hustle for a litany of reasons, bills being the predominant one. You gotta pay your bills. So don't let it equate to, oh, geez,
Oh yeah, no. I have a side hustle still. I do property management on the side, and that's more just to even out my cash flow than anything. But it's just a, yeah. I mean, that's a big problem in this industry is you get once you start to get like big credits behind you and you actually start to really get consistent work, you'll get big checks, but you don't know how long they need to last you. So that's, again, that's why property management is a great side hustle for me.
No, I think, we all should be thinking that way. It's that multiple streams of revenue coming in, and the lottery is just that. It's a lottery. Nothing you can count on. Thinking of the end in mind, starting out with filmmaking, distribution is obviously one that is a vast topic. But for indie filmmakers, when do you suggest that a filmmaker starts to speak to a distributor? And also, what material should they expect to have? And if I can maybe one up you too, is the marketing around that what mostly don't filmmakers think of? So distribution, when they should come speak to you, what material, and then talk a little bit maybe about marketing.
Yeah, so I'll start by saying that most filmmakers don't think about distribution early enough, but it's a much bigger problem if you don't think about marketing early enough. And they're not the same. And especially if you're making a small, low-budget independent film, your distributor isn't going to have the bandwidth to do most of your marketing and audience discovery for you. You kind of have to do a lot of that yourself and go from zero to one yourself. And then your distributor, if they're good at their job, will help take you from one to 10. And there are a myriad of different ways you can do that. But it's just not possible for us as distributors, given that we take a good distribution split is going to be anywhere between 25 and 40% on the commission. That is very hard to run a business off of if you're more towards the 25%. And if you're on the 40%, they should be paying you up front. And that is also something you have to account for. So it's more the it's extremely time intensive to do the early stages of marketing. So you should be doing it as a filmmaker functionally from when you write your script. And that is not, I'm not saying, hey, I wrote the script. You should like this, this, or this. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about engaging with your core audience from even before you write your script, at very least when it's complete, just to become a part of that community and not be asking for anything in the meantime until the film is actually getting closer to out or until you're running a crowdfunding campaign. There's actually something for an ask. You should be engaging at least a year before you start asking for anything. And that's hard, but we're not talking about spending 8 hours a day on Reddit. We're talking about maybe half an hour to an hour a day across all socials, just engaging and being there.
Yeah, exactly. I do a lot of fantasy and sci-fi mainly because it's not that I don't have other stories and other genres. It's just that that is one that I love myself, that I'm very involved with, I'm engaged with, and that I know I can find. They're not hiding. You know, sci-fi and fantasy fans are not hiding. You can engage with them.
There I as one of those nerds myself, I agree. We don't hide, and in fact sometimes we even go to conventions.
Exactly. There is a little thing called conventions that have become pretty popular. Have you worked with production companies that are soliciting for content scripts and then, you know, getting that greenlit to then, you know, through the filmmaking process? Have you been on that side of it from moment of, hey, I have a script to a production company looking for something, and then, you know, bridging the two. Have you been involved in any of that type of transactions?
So most of what I do as it pertains to finance is directly for clients, is more around debt than equity and secured assets for debt, which means pre-sales and tax incentives functionally most of the time. There are other things you can monetize, but those are the big ones, and that's like 80% of debt, of backed debt and gap debt you don't want to take unless you have no better option. And then actually, but you do want as much backed debt as possible. Ideally, you want more than 50% of your pie to basically be paid for once the film is delivered. And that's not easy, but it can be done. It's just a lot less risky for all involved. And you keep more of the back end if you do that because your investors, instead of financing the whole thing via equity, they end up financing ideally about half, which means that they only take anywhere between, depending on your financial mix, 30 to 40% of the pie as opposed to 60, which is big for you. But the what I've done in terms of, like, most of the time I work with producers, not production companies. So sometimes people will approach me with a completed script. The most common way that I start working with them is I help them create documentation for investors, and I help assess pre-sales and things like that. And then sometimes I'll even help option an intellectual property, like a book or a comic or anything like that. And then I don't do a ton until the end of production. Often, if I'm involved at that stage, I will go out for a visit, though, because it's nice to be on set, even if I'm not necessary.
No,
So,
absolutely. No,
yeah.
that's, I mean, if you don't get out on set, why are we all here? You know, I mean, that's the sizzle.
Yeah.
We all, production is the fun part. People think that's the work. And although there is work to be done, that is the sizzle. That is the fun that we talk about. Pre-sales. I'm hearing a lot of like murmurings about pre-sales. Can you maybe give us a just a kind of a recent thought on that? Are they still
Yeah,
valid?
you can still get them. They're hard to get. Honestly, I have a feeling that they might become proportionately more common in the next few years. Mainly because pre-sales become more common when there isn't a glut of equity in the market. And it's basically that these distributors always need to fill their pipelines. And when there isn't a lot of available equity, that means there are fewer films that they can count on being done when it's when the film itself when they need to fill that pipeline. So they'll pre-buy to make sure that it's full when they get there. They do end up paying slightly less in an ideal system than they would when it's completed. But when there's a glut of films and too much equity in the market, they might end up paying less when it's done than they would early. Like, I won't say names here, but we had a very interested sales agent slash distributor for, I'll say, the movie. It was for Tim Travers. And I basically said, okay, well, we're open to talk turkey. Here's in order to do this, I'm going to need 125% of the production budget, basically, because I need to make sure the investors are taken care of. There's some back end, there's some guild residuals that need to go. This is the minimum I can really accept at this point. And they laughed at me, literally. And it's like, you're trying to buy this when we're not yet selling it. So maybe don't laugh when I ask for a price on that. So,
You're asking to take it off the market, and I know I've gotten some of my projects the low ball. I mean, it's embarrassing numbers, you know,
Oh,
embarrassing.
yeah. No, they were like looking, I think it was like at best 15% of the budget. And it's like, no.
Yeah, exactly. You're gonna lock it up for what and where, and no, that's not gonna work. Like the math doesn't work, and it's
No.
a little insulting that you're not seeing that because we do. And of course, so we, you know, obviously pre-sales a lot of times are predicated on that named person. I've seen this topic kind of go up and down, and I'd love to get your perspective on it. Where's your kind of sense of how important is star power today?
In general, if you want minimum guarantees, you need a name and a face, basically. And you need that face on the poster for international sales if you want sizable MGs. And I'm specifically speaking about from foreign territories there. Most of the time, your sales agent will not give you an MG, but a good sales agent will get MGs for you. And for the first year you're out there, they shouldn't be looking at anything that isn't an MG, basically. It's a so they're absolutely vital there. And just going back to pre-sales for a moment, there are three basic things you need to be able to get a pre-sale. One is a recognizable name and face to sell it. Two is a known director who's done something before so that they know it can be delivered. I guess it's kind of four, but and then three is a concept that is not execution dependent. This means something that no matter how well the film comes out, it will still be sellable. This is like Fast 10 or Expendables 17, however they're up to there.
Yeah.
As opposed to something like Moonlight.
Yeah.
Or even La La Land to a level. But the there would be anything that might go sideways really quickly is something you probably won't be able to pre-sell.
Yeah.
And it's really just about risk mitigation on the distributor's end there.
Right.
And all of that is to say, even then, you're not guaranteed a pre-sale. You're just in a much better position for
right,
it.
Right.
And then the other thing that was kind of for is you'll need a completion bond. That's just. And in general, you should also know the difference between a negative pickup, a backstop, and a pre-sale. The negative pickup is technically different from a pre-sale, but in common parlance, it can basically be used interchangeably. Mostly a lawyer would disagree, but ask your entertainment attorney for that difference. I am not one. But the big one is between a backstop and a pre-sale. A backstop has a set buyout period, and I would always go for a backstop over a pre-sale because it cuts that risk from taking the deal too early.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, pulling that forward. What genres, and again, thinking through the indie lens, what genres are you seeing doing well financially? Not necessarily what are the most popular, but what's selling out there? What genres are selling?
Can you hear that, dog?
No.
Okay, great. My studio works then. The biggest ones are pretty much same as they always were. Big genres don't tend to change too much for indie films. They are action, horror, animated family, then kind of thriller, but thriller's a lot more execution dependent. And those are the ones that will sell. I kind of consider settings differently. Like World War II is almost always easy to sell, but it has to be action and has to have tanks and ideally planes too. If it's just like if it's a drama or a thriller set in a backdrop of World War II, that's a lot harder than it is to sell something like a true action film. And then another one that is extraordinarily popular in the genre circles right now is sci-fi. And I don't think that one's going away super soon, but subgenres tend to fluctuate a lot more than main genres. And one thing that it was only really solidified for me once I started attending the European markets and selling and really like focusing a bit more on international sales meetings as opposed to just working directly to distribute a film and parse very specific media right types in North America. Animated family is probably the easiest thing in the world to sell, but live action family is extremely limited and does not export all that well.
Oh, interesting.
It's mainly because of language gaps.
Yeah.
You can do pretty well in the in any English speaking territory, but you'd have to dub the kids into another territory, and that gets expensive. There's so many cultural things that don't make sense to little kids.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to do that. So if you're making a live action family film, and just for the record for anyone listening, when we in distribution and sales say family, we mean children's.
Yeah.
We don't mean like adult family coming to terms and slice of life films or anything like that. We mean Disney movies is what we mean. But animated family, that'll sell for days. because that's really easy to dub and translate, because there's no, I mean, if you just think about it for a second, why on earth would you subtitle a film that's mainly targeted at people under 12?
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. They would turn it off, or they couldn't read it fast enough, or just a lot of barriers.
Yeah.
that's interesting. Are you seeing a good bit of like animated family? Cause that's, I would imagine that price point would make me nervous. You know, that it seems like an expensive genre.
It is an expensive genre. So basically most of that is financed via presale. And a lot of times it ends up that distributors and sales agents end up financing a lot of it, and often even end up producing it these days. And I do think that's going to be an emerging trend as we go forward, especially after the success of Blood and Honey from Stuart Olson in ITN Distribution. I've known him for years, although I'm not convinced he remembers me. He is like kind of a big fish around the markets now, specifically because of Blood and Honey.
That's awesome. Good for him. I mean, I've seen that more too, where sales agents are just not getting the flow that they need, and therefore, boom, they're like producing stuff out there. One of my old sales agents early on, Highland Film Group, produced a lot of stuff now, where in the early days they didn't do any of it. So
yeah, it's the least risky way to do it, frankly. We know exactly what our buyers are looking for.
I mean, you're speaking to the buyer, right?
We watch a lot of movies too. Right. Like, I mean, I don't watch as much contemporary movies as I should, but that's because I get 3 to 5 submissions a week.
Wow.
And if I want to actually keep up with that submission queue, I have no active watch energy left in me. So I rewatch bad TV, because it's just, I don't have to expend energy on
it. Yeah, you can unplug.
Yeah.
On that note, what is generally a main reason why a filmmaker would reach out to you these days? Is it mostly for consulting around distribution? Is it mostly for producing or producer rep? And if so, of either direction, what would be the best way to contact you?
So either way, I have forms on my site that are for either early stage or completed films. And there's also just general contact form if it's something that's not quite in that doesn't really fit into either. And that does hit me directly. The reason that I make people fill out forms is just to be able to streamline my own process so that I can actually manage my workflow without hiring people. Because it's a pretty lean business. And that means that I don't have to charge closer to like the 30 or 40%. I have to keep it at a pretty reasonable industry standard. That does vary a little bit depending on the project and the expected workflow, which is why I'm not saying the amount. Most of the time when I'm working with somebody new, it's either with a completed film that is seeking North American distribution and or international sales connections. If it's with an earlier stage film, it's some degree of consulting. Most often it's around like documentation for investors and sales projections and things like that. That's most of what I do. And those are the two easiest. Those are the two most common ways. There are exceptions, but
And people probably know you if they know you on some level, probably know various other ways you could help them, and then come at you with, hey, how about this, you know, kind of thing. I would imagine what's an ideal project for you to come your way. And if a project is not funded, that still might not negate your ability to help. You still might be willing to come in and help with that. You don't need, in other words, a fully funded project potentially to engage you. But what would be an ideal project for you? What would it look like?
On the completed side, most of the stuff I end up taking are well-executed psychological thrillers. I will always look at and often take a good horror movie, because it's I know the right people for it. And it may not happen to be my number one favorite genre. I'm more of a thriller guy than a horror guy, but I appreciate the medium enough that I can really help a lot there. A lot of that has to do with my role as CEO of Mutiny Pictures too, which was we did a lot of horror movies there, including I Am Lisa, and then one of the last things we signed before we sold it was Skinamarink. So that was a big one. In terms of what, and if you bring me an action movie, like an actual well-executed action movie that doesn't drag in the middle, and has safely done and believable action, not bad green screen CGI sort of stuff, it's yeah, I'll take that in a heartbeat, and I know exactly the people you want to talk to about it. So those are the ones that, and then again, if you have a completed animated family movie, by all means, I will take that. But the way I describe it to filmmakers is, I'm sure everyone listening to this has seen the original Ghostbusters. If you haven't, probably pause this right here and go watch it and then come back. But it's a there's this one scene where Sigourney Weaver walks into the office, is talking to the receptionist, and then Bill Murray stands up and sees her, then vaults over this gate to in order to talk to her. That's how every single sales agent at every single market responds when somebody says they have a completed animated family adventure movie. It's like all of us, everyone wants it because we know it's extremely easy to flip and make a really good amount of money for. And so yeah, I want those. In terms of if you're looking for more producing services, or at very least producer of marketing and distribution services, a solid script, a good attitude, and I do charge something up front for that because it's way too long a tail for me to not, basically. So it's a, but I do stand by my work and I charge no more and often less than people who do the same sorts of services. So,
No, like I said, in all sincerity, I've heard nothing but good things about you and what you do and your ability to deliver and even price point and things. So I can definitely appreciate that. If a film fights you every step of the way, that's kind of one of my sayings. What are some of the hurdles that you've had to overcome as a filmmaker? And then maybe if you can also caveat into an obvious one, which is the money problem, how are people solving the money problem? So hurdles and then the money problem.
So it's a bit of a catch-22 making a film. You need generally you need to have three things. You need to have obviously money, and we'll come back to that. A package, which is like a good crew, a tested crew. And then you need recognizable names. And sorry, actually a package which would include the recognizable names, and then you need distribution is the third one. I kind of forget distribution because it's what I do all the time, so it's always there. But those are the three things you need. And in order to get the first one, financing, you really need to have the other two. And in order to get the talent, they'll say they need it to be completely finalized and financed, but that's an easier one to break through than the money is. The easiest one to start with, in my opinion, is attaching a sales agent or a distributor. It's entirely a relationship game. So you need to be able to build relationships with, frankly, people like me and other sales agents and distributors. And at that point, once you have a good distributor, the agents, actors are going to take you a lot more seriously. And that you can sometimes get the LOI based on the distributor. The other way to break through this role, through the talent, is to hire a really good casting director. But most of the time, they won't defer and they're expensive. I don't want, because you can see who we used on Travers because it's public at this point. I don't want to say exactly what she charged us, but she was worth every cent. And it was, and frankly, the only reason we got her is the director used to be our intern. So it's a, even that's a relationship game. But she, I don't even know if she's really taking on new projects, but she is, and that's because she's in her 80s at this point. But she was the casting director on Reservoir Dogs.
Awesome.
So that's like, that let us punch above our weight for Travers in a pretty big way. But yeah. Yeah, so and then once you have those two, that doesn't guarantee the last bit of financing, but it makes it so you have a fighting chance. And again, start with get as much money in place from non-equity as you can, as in generally tax incentive and pre-sales. And if you can get to 50% and you have a package, you're starting to look like a fairly reasonable investment. It's still going to be high risk, but it's going to be a lot, but you'll set yourself apart from most other film productions if that they would see, because most moneyed individuals have been approached by a filmmaker at one point or another.
Where do you, so I bring this question up, and the desire is not to Monday morning quarterback people. It is truly from a desire to try to learn. So I'll say it a little bit directly, but I don't mean it with that thrust behind it. But where do you see creatives blowing it? Where do you see them blow it?
Not thinking about marketing early enough. I mean, well, so, okay. That what I said is true, but to be more specific, not thinking about who's actually going to watch their movie early enough. It's not even about figuring out how to reach these people. You have to first figure out who you're trying to reach. And you need to be thinking about that at the script stage. There is a, I mean, Alex Ferrari actually has a really good section in his Film Tripreneur book on this. And yeah, that's a, and there are some other podcasts as well, including the Filmmaker Freedom podcast, which was, yeah, there's a four-part series on that. Yeah, it on specifically identifying your target market. So yeah. That would be the biggest one. And the other is just not thinking about it as a business, because it is a creative endeavor, but it's also, if you want to make your money back, it's got to be a business, because you just won't. And unfortunately, there are nobody really wants to watch independent dramas or comedies without recognizable names. And that problem gets a lot worse if you mix genres, especially dramas and comedies or dramedies. That's basically if most distributors or sales agents see the word dramedy in a pitch, it's on the throwaway pile.
It's on the out. Unfortunately, I'm kind of hearing and seeing the same myself, but I'm not seeing a huge response to that. And again, you know, there's always exceptions to every rule. Everybody thinks
always. Yeah.
But they're, so it's hard to say like absolutes, but, you know, dirt definitely seems to be the trend. Like you kind of hit on this a little bit, but I've always been intrigued by this question. How does one, you seem to have been in the business quite some time now, a long time. And how does one have longevity in this industry? And how does one find contentment within it?
You have to love the work first. You just, because it'll eat you alive even if you love it. But if you don't love it, you won't survive. And honestly, a lot of this, a lot of success in this is survival. Just staying alive and showing up again and again long enough that you can no longer be ignored. And I have specifically said in a few places where part of this game is just surviving.
Yeah.
And I've had people say, well, no, I mean, we want to thrive. It's like, yeah, I agree, but you got to start somewhere, basically. Yeah. And in order to thrive, you have to make it far, survive long enough to do so. It's it is what it is. And also, it's better to think of this as a sustainable small business being your goal, as opposed to creating a high growth business, because you're probably not going to do that. It's by all means, I want you to. I'm sure Ron wants you as well.
Absolutely.
Just realistically, you're probably not going to get there. But if you can make it to the point where you are making enough money to survive and live and go out to eat every once in a while and make a movie every year, you're in a really good position probably going to live a happy life.
Right.
And that's really what that's about. So it's, don't go into it expecting to be Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Because I'm not even sure Steven Spielberg would be Steven Spielberg if he started today.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I even heard him say something very similar. So it's totally, totally true. Go for it. I'm sorry.
Actually, so while we're there, I've met Francis Ford Coppola twice.
Wow.
Both mostly random. Although I did represent one of his nephew's movies once. But the and there's something he said that I'll never really forget, which was, Apocalypse. I told him Apocalypse Now is a lot of why I went to film school. So thank you for that. And he said, no, I'm sorry. Because so few people actually see any degree of success in this. And he said he makes more money in his wine business in a single year than he has in his entire career as a filmmaker, which is...
That's mind-blowing, because it's Coppola.
Coppola. Yeah, it's like... he's... So it's just something to keep in mind on the...
Yeah.
I don't think it's not... any, this business isn't anywhere near what it used to be. So...
Yeah. I do like his wine. He does have good wine.
He does have good wine. Yes.
What are your thoughts on film festivals? Certainly I think they can help with developing your pedigree, but there also seems to be a film festival in every small town across this great country. So what are your thoughts on film festivals? Any thought there for a filmmaker?
Yeah, actually, my thoughts on this have evolved over time. I used to be a lot more negative about them than I am now. But the biggest thing I will say is that you need to have a goal when you're going into one. And in general, the only ones that will really help you with distribution are tier two and above, which would be like, I would consider Cinequest tier two. Seattle International Film Fest is tier two. Brussels International Fantastic Film Fest is kind of middle top of tier two. Sitges, I'm saying that wrong. Sitges in near Barcelona in Spain is almost the tippy top of tier two. And then places like Fright Fest will help you. And I know I'm naming a lot of genre festivals, but it's just kind of where my head is because I've been working on that lately. And the below that, there's still value that can be had. It's more about engaging with your audience, but they're not going to mean much to your distributor or your sales agent. And just since I listed a bunch of tier twos, tier one would be Cannes, Venice, Sundance, Slam Dance, Tribeca, TIFF, South by Southwest, and basically maybe three others in the same general tier. And if you get into the tier ones, that's going to make a big difference. Maybe not as big a difference as you expect, because still only about 10% of films out of Sundance get a distribution deal.
That which is crazy
It's
statistic.
an insane statistic that I still have. I've been saying that one for like at least a year, and I still haven't wrapped my head around it. But yeah.
It's an act of God just to get in, and then it's like, wait, only 10% get an offer? Good grief.
Yeah,
So
I know. And like Ted Hope tried to do something better while he was ahead of Amazon Studios there, but they discontinued that like the second he left. So,
jeez. I think I kind of re remember something about that. What are your thoughts on because us indies are always trying to get our films out there. What are your thoughts on aggregators? Any thoughts there?
I just don't know if the economics of the pay up front model work. I don't know how you can run a sustainable business based on that. I think that's part of why distributor imploded the way it did. I actually haven't checked in on BitMax lately. I know they were having a little bit of trouble, but the hopefully they've recovered because they basically took over from distributor. FilmHub, I think, is a much more sustainable model there. They don't like being called aggregators, but I have they're I see why they don't like it, but I also think it's closer to the reality of what they are. And I would, and to be fair, I would also say something really similar about indie rights, and I'm sure Linda would hate me saying that. But the so I just don't think it's a I think if you need to get it out there, it's not the worst thing to do, but I do think you really need to make sure that you're fine committing to not having traditional distribution. Because if you do that, it's not like you can just take it down and everything will be fine. You will lose a lot of your market, and most distributors won't touch it.
I think you and I share a lot of similar thoughts there. I don't know that that should be. I hear filmmakers recently, like that is their plan. That's their first at the top of the tier plan. And I just don't know that that I just haven't seen the numbers work that way yet. Very rarely, very rarely.
Yeah, I agree with you. If you can market your work, it can work really well. That's the
I
big
could see
if.
that. I could see that.
And it's just you have to figure that you are going to spend a lot more time and money marketing. And if you haven't actually marketed something before, I mean, anything, it's probably not the path you want to take. It's a, that said, no distribution deal is always better than a bad distribution deal. So it's a balancing act. And it's a, and if you've already been, if you haven't been able to find distribution, the film's already been past its festival run by 2 years, it's probably time. Just do it. But yeah, it's a, but if it's, yeah, no, I would just say don't go into it with your plan unless you have the ability to really hustle your butt off here. Because it, and I, even then, I wouldn't necessarily say it should be your first plan. Of course, I'm in the industry, so I have my own bias there. And I know most filmmakers don't trust sales agents and distributors, and frankly, there's good reason for that. But the it's just most films don't make their aggregation fees back for like iTunes. If you iTunes, Apple TV, whatever it
is. Yeah, yeah.
There was a time period, it may not be true anymore, where only about 3 out of 10 films even made the aggregation fees back.
Oh, wow.
For Apple. And that's brutal.
That is brutal.
That's, yeah, it's just, and it's always been a sink or swim market, but like you just have to keep in mind that just because it's available doesn't mean people will buy it.
Yep, I say that quite a bit. This isn't on, wasn't one of my questions, but it did kind of pop in. Are you seeing a certain budget range for an indie producer that seems to work? It seems that, you know, you go too low, the quality suffers. If you go too high, you break even. It becomes so ridiculous that you're not going to ever make your money back. Do you kind of have a sweet spot, that a recommendation, like, hey, consider between these parameters?
Yeah, that's a really hard one to give because it has a lot to do with the overall quality and the genre of the film too.
Yeah.
So the way I'd say it is, first, quality is key. It is the bar for quality since the end of the pandemic has risen probably about tenfold. So it's just so much the level of quality that buyers need in order to buy these days is so much harder than it was even when I started my distribution company. The other thing is, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a range that will always work, because there isn't, but I would say that if you are spending anything more than 100 to 150 on production, you are going to need a name in it for a bit. And you can try to, if you're smart, you can schedule them for like 2 days and intersperse them throughout the movie so they feel like they're a much bigger part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a that's at least part of what we did on Tim Travers.
Yeah.
But you need the names. And I won't say which big distributor this is, but if you want like the tier one distributors, which are the names you see when you go to a movie theater, basically, their name dependency is a lot higher than you might think. It's something that, again, I don't want to name who it was, but somebody very recently said arguably our biggest name in Travers didn't even register on their radar.
No, wow.
And I don't know if you know this. You might not know about this because it's still early. But Tim Travers had Danny Trejo, Felicia Day, Joel McHale, and Keith David as celebrities in it. And by the way, an incredible performance by Sam Dunning, which was his debut feature. So that was, he literally played like 40 of himself. So it was fantastic.
Awesome. Yeah.
But but those big names there, I listed who is arguably the biggest. That didn't even matter, basically. It's like it didn't even register on the radar, which is to me a little insane.
That is, because if it's, you know, who we're all thinking of, they've had a good career. I mean, they're recognizable, they are well established name in the industry. So is frustrating, frankly.
It was.
I bet. I love Felicia Day. I did see her, that she was a part of it too. That's awesome.
So incredibly nice.
Yeah. She's nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
It was great to get to hang out with her both on set and at Cinequest.
She's very cool.
Yeah.
You already mentioned one, but and I know you have a book. Do you have any books that you would recommend to creatives, either entrepreneurially or otherwise?
Freakonomics changed my entire outlook on life. I'm not sure all of the studies still hold up because it's kind of an older book at this point.
Yeah.
But the entire just changing how you think about people and incentives. And it's the first time that that economic theory actually made sense to me. And I've taken economic classes, but it was the reading that was really what crystallized it. And I think that that is something that the creative type might be able to get more behind too.
I like it.
But that's one. I mean, obviously there's mine. But
yeah, let's mention that.
Yeah. It's The Gorilla Rep, American Film Market Distribution Success on No Budget. It's on Audible as well. And if you like hearing my voice now, you'll hear a lot more of it there. But the so that's a I mean I actually haven't read that in like probably 5 years or so, mainly because I know if I reread it, I'm going to rewrite it and make a new edition, and I don't have that kind of time right now. So it's a God, what other books? I should have actually thought about that.
I like Freakonomics. That's a definite good one. I would totally recommend that one.
Freakonomics is a really good one. I do go back and forth on Gladwell as well. Malcolm Gladwell. He has some good stuff. Outliers is a good book. I'm forgetting the author, but The Power of Habit is another good one. Those are the ones I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah.
They're all
good ones. I'm an Audible guy for sure. You know, like driving to the gym in the morning and try to listen. I try to do a fun book and then like a self-help book, you know, kind of toggle between. So
I do the same thing. I actually just re-listened to The Hunger Games.
Oh, fun. I'm knee deep in Firefly. They came out with a whole series of books in the world of Firefly, and I've just been knee deep and I only had to pay for like a couple of them. They were free within Audible. If you have an Audible account, you could download like four or five of them. So, and they are really well written, and the audio voiceover guy is phenomenal. I mean, it sounds like the people, you know, it's amazing. So definite fun series.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah,
yeah, you should. No, if you like Firefly, it definitely is in the world and in the vein of. What is an important thing you would tell an aspiring creative? Someone who's just starting out.
It's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
It's a, maybe it's even a triathlon. I don't know. But the,
yeah, that might be closer to it. You're right.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it probably is closer to a triathlon. It's not just about doing the same thing. It's about being skilled at multiple disciplines.
Yeah.
At a decently high level.
Yeah. No, it's actually a really good visual.
Yeah. It's gonna take a while, and you're gonna have a lot of late nights, and you're gonna eat a lot of ramen, for lack of a better cheap food stuff.
yeah,
but yeah, it's gonna take a while, and you're probably gonna have to work a lot of crappy, demeaning jobs you hate along the way. But just remember that when you do actually get to do the thing that the creative parts, it's completely soul fulfilling, and it will bring you back. At least if this is where you're supposed to be, that's what will happen.
Yeah, I like it. What are you working on now, and how can people find and support you?
Right now, I am primarily doing the back end work that for Tim Travers, that gets it out there in the big way that it needs to be. And the best way to find what I'm up to and stay up to date with what I'm doing is my email list, which is at thegorillarep.com/resources, and you get a free investment deck template, free festival brochure, which I actually just used at the CineQuest premiere, my own template. So I practice what I preach there, and a bunch of other free goodies there that are just for your email. And you also get a monthly blog digest based on varies month to month, but it's film financing, distribution, marketing, stuff like that. Just an easy to read continued self-education guide. So.
Yeah. That's awesome, Ben. Well, I certainly appreciate your time, man. I appreciate everybody watching or listening, however you're kind of taking this in. Of course, I'd ask that you like and subscribe. It does help the channel to help get the word out. But I believe we are good to conclude our discussion with Ben. Definitely appreciate the wealth of knowledge that you have gathered and then passed on a little bit to us. So I do hope that you stay well. Until next time, keep swinging for the fences and be well. Thanks, everyone.